Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Virginia Hume, author of the debut novel, Haven Point. Virginia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Jeff.
Yeah, sure. If someone hasn't heard about your novel, Haven Point, yet, how would you describe the novel?
Haven Point is a family saga. It's the story of three generations of women in the Demarest family. Marin, her daughter Anne, and Anne's daughter Skye, each of whom, for their own reasons and in their own time, have feelings of ambivalence about, or in some cases even antipathy toward, the little community on the main coast, the eponymous Haven Point, where the Demarests have spent summers since the late 19th century. Marin eventually makes her peace with the place, but at the end of the summer of 1970, her 17-year-old daughter Anne leaves and vows never to return, a promise she keeps until her untimely death 38 years later. Anne's daughter Skye never really questioned her mother's aversion to Haven Point, which she basically shares. It just seemed like a pretty straightforward culture clash between her mom's very bohemian art teacher and this very waspy, hidebound, insular summer colony. But there was more to it. And after the prologue, in which that central mystery, small m mystery, is set up, the full story unfolds through the interwoven narratives of the grandmother, Marin, and the granddaughter, Skye. Their two narratives present almost a before and after picture of Anne Demarest. And they cover the period from 1944, when Marin is a cadet nurse in Washington, D.C. during World War II and first meets Oliver Demarest, all the way up to and through that summer of 1970. And then Skye's story begins when she's 14 in 1994. Marin introduces the reader to young Annie Demarest, as she was known when she was young, is very charismatic and impulsive and creative and mostly joyful. And through Skye, Anne's daughter, we see a still charismatic, still impulsive, still creative, but much more troubled adult. So it's lots of family drama, lots of betrayals and reconciliations and grief and triumph, as a family will have, and lots of the kinds of interpersonal challenges that one faces in a tiny little, very traditional community like Haven Point.
And do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to write Haven Point?
I think it's hard to say, but I spent my very earliest summers at my grandfather's house on Old Black Point, which is a summer colony on the Connecticut shore. My mother's from Hartford, Connecticut, and I was born there. And he sold the house when I was really small, but I'm persuaded something must have gotten into my bloodstream, because I've always been drawn to these little communities that people return to year after year. So I really started with setting. And I would say Haven Point is really almost a character in and of itself in this novel. And from there, I thought, gosh, I'd love to write a novel set in a place like this. And then I went to, what's the sort of novel I like to read? And I do like a good multi-generational family saga. So those were the first two thoughts, and I took it from there.
Well, your novel features three generations, as you explain. How did you try to capture the voice and the time period for each of the main characters?
That's a really good question, because it was actually a big challenge. You know, when I initially wrote this, it was two-thirds of the novel still, I would say, are Marin's story, the grandmother. Because it covers a lot more territory. I considered writing Skye's narrative starting when she was younger. As I think I said, she's 14 years old when her chapters of her narrative begin. And I realized it was trying to capture the thoughts, it's in third person close, of someone so young. It didn't really work, because, I mean, I thought I could do it, and I've read novels where authors have attempted that. I just didn't think she would have the kinds of thoughts, would form the sorts of thoughts when she was much younger that you're trying to convey. I wrote a lot of Skye's story very separately. It was a little bit easier for me, which is odd because Marin's obviously of a different generation, to write in Marin's voice. Skye's I found a little harder, but they're extremely distinct in terms of their personalities, and Skye's certainly a more modern character and younger. And there were times where I felt like the way I was describing Skye's thoughts that I was slipping in a little bit to Marin's voice. So I had to actually go back a lot. There was a lot of editing, especially of Skye's story, for exactly that reason.
Well, I'm curious because Haven Point is a debut novel. What was your writing journey that led you to writing and getting this novel published?
So I started Haven Point. It was quite a long journey because I was working and had kids when I started this. So it was kind of a side hustle. And I don't like to say that I always wanted to write a novel because I feel like that sounds so sad. You know, it's like you've had this burning, unfulfilled desire for all of your life. I actually came to it after a long career mostly in politics and public affairs, where I did a lot of writing for my work. It was more like a recurrent ambition, though, something that would pop up. And I think, oh, I'd really like to try that. And I had actually taken a couple of very brief stabs at starting a novel before. I did a lot more talking about writing a novel than actually doing so. And I had gone out on my own after I spent 13 years working at a couple different public affairs firms, working in communications, and had gone out on my own to practice. My kids were at a certain school age where it was just made more sense. And I found myself increasingly taking projects that were pure writing projects. I began to appreciate the craft and what I was able to deliver. And then I was on vacation and I thought, I think I'm ready to start this. This time I chose to write a novel and not talk about it rather than talk about it and not do it. And I will say that worked much better. I mean, it wasn't this big secret that I kept from everybody, but I just made a habit of not talking about it beyond friends and a number of people who were, family and a number of friends who were helping me in various ways. And I think that was a good approach. It sort of helped me keep the main thing the main thing. I wasn't sort of publicly identified with. And I think it also helped me do something else, which was useful, which was let go of outcomes. You know, I knew I was, of course, I wanted to get it published. As my husband will tell you, I don't need another hobby. But I felt like I had time to kind of wrestle it to the ground and learn. And so I did have a draft in about a year and a half. And I circulated that among some early readers and got their feedback. And then I went through various rounds of edits, but there were periods where, you know, I had a year where I had a really tricky client, another year where I pulled myself off because I kind of got pulled back into politics and was doing some writing or some magazine work for that. And I actually sold it. It's coming out June 2021, but I actually sold it in April of 2019. So it's been quite the long runway to publication.
And so what was that actual path to publication? I mean, once you had a final draft and edited and you know, feedback from your readers, did you work with an agent and how was that process?
I did. It's funny. I sometimes think that I took the keep the main thing and let go of outcomes a little far because I approached each step. I was like, okay, time to get an agent. How do you get an agent? I just didn't do a ton of research along the way. I did actually one more step. There was a point at which I had sent the novel to a friend who works. She's not a literary agent herself, but she works for, or is a, she's an attorney who works with literary agents. Mm-hmm. And she passed it along to someone. And the feedback was, it was good. It got kind of, obviously, so the first person at an agency who reads a manuscript, I think, is usually pretty junior. And then if they like it. I used to have that job. Oh, did you?
Yeah, years ago.
That would be, it would be fun to think you were part of, you know, someone who would had enough vision to kick something upstairs that was worthwhile. And it did get kicked upstairs. You know, someone had liked it, but then it got passed around. It sat there for 9 months and it was coincided with the time where I had other work that was keeping me very busy. And the feedback came back and it was a little hard for me to digest. And I wound up working with a professional editor. And that was really helpful. I think that got it into, it's hard for me to say whether, you know, when I sent it out to more agents, once I had made the editor suggestions, whether I would have landed an agent if I hadn't done what the editor suggested. So I sent out to a bunch of agents and I had actually a couple who were interested, but I had gleaned from feedback I'd gotten from others. It was overall, I have to say, a pretty positive experience. I think partly because I expected everyone to say no. I mean, most people say no. Right. I just, you know, they're reading to say no. Nobody can take everything. And you can only have one agent, but they were such encouraging no's. But I could tell there was something that still needed to be done. And I really had taken it about as far as I could. I had no idea what else I could do. And when it came down to it, both the agents who were interested were terrific. But one, Susanna Einstein, who ended up representing me and who's been wonderful, had just her suggestions for the manuscript. It really resonated with me. I thought they made a lot of sense. So I went through another round of edits, making Susanna's suggestions. And then she sent it out. It sold, as I said, in April of 2019. And it was only out for, it was a couple weeks. It sold on a preempt to Sarah Canton, who's my editor at St. Martin's Press. And she had more ideas. So, but we actually talked about them because one of her, we talked about them before I got the contract. And there were two things she wanted to run by me. One was a thought for restructuring the novel, which was, and it's amazing having just listed for you the incredible amount of input I'd already had that no one, myself or any of the smart people who'd worked on it before had thought of, but it was something that made a lot of sense. And the other was that she wanted to wait to bring it out until 2021. It's definitely a summer release, and summer 2020 would have been a little tight. And as we now know, summer 2020 probably wouldn't have been a great time.
Yeah, probably
to
not
have a debut novel come out. So, I was delighted. I thought her ideas made a lot of sense. I was very excited to work with her. And once we had that conversation, then the offer came, I think, the next day. So a preempt, as you know, and I don't know if most of your listeners know, is sort of a handsome offer that takes it off the table. The other editors have a very brief window to...
Right.
To read it and respond. So it's not crazy. It's not like some wild auction or something, but it was good enough. And I was so thrilled with her thoughts. And she's been an absolutely spectacular editor. I got unbelievably lucky.
That's great. Well, I guess the next question would be, are you writing a second novel now?
I am writing a second novel. I had, you know, you do some world building in these, you know, when you create a community like Haven Point. And I thought, gosh, you know, people might want another novel set in the same place. And I was completely resistant to this idea. I have a slightly rebellious streak. And I wanted to write a novel about, a biographical fiction novel about a great-great aunt of mine who was an artist and a suffragette and an all-around interesting character. And I was on vacation last summer and I was in Maine. And I thought, wait, why don't I bring my great aunt to Haven Point? And I came up with a story with three interwoven narratives because I, unlike most people, debut novelists are famous for their ambition because you don't know what you're doing. And so you bite off way more than you can chew. And most of them learn with a second novel to do something a little perhaps less complicated or sweeping or extravagant, but not me. I've added a third narrative, and I've also parked the whole story for the second novel in the 1890s. So I'm adding more historical research, and but it's a fun story. I'm excited. It isn't done, but I've been spending a lot of time working on it. It's pretty well developed. And I did NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month, last November, and worked out pretty much one of the narratives almost completely and made good progress on the second one. So
when you say that you're working on these narratives, do you find in your writing and your editing process that you write one narrative and then you kind of weave them together in the editing process?
So in a way, yes. I'm backing up a little bit. Mm-hmm, I think sure. With Haven Point, I the story that I came up with, which was really over the first few weeks that I was thinking about, really ended up being the story to a large extent. But I knew that when I started the big beats, and so I had sort of a rough outline. I knew where the story was going. I knew what the ending would be and what the big beats were. I did end up weaving some more in along the way, but I wrote it basically in sections. So I didn't have a detailed outline. Mm-hmm. It was kind of fun in that way because, you know, it's very creative. It's coming up with the whole story. You know, the entire arc is a neat creative process too. But then how are you going to tell it? You know, it's, you know, something is going to happen in one particular part of the novel, but how are you going to make that happen? You know, from whose perspective and what are the scenes that will comprise it? And so I tackled each one of those individually and wrote them individually. The original structure of Haven Point was different. Sarah had, what we ended up with, these two interwoven narratives, was not the way I had originally written it. It works much, much better. And I realized that once it got written, and once I really started to tackle the rewrite that I did for my editor at St. Martin's, this one, I outlined a lot more, because you realize how much you end up tossing out when you write the entire thing beginning to end. And I just learned a lot from the first novel. So I'm outlining, and it has to be woven together before I write it because the stories are so, the threads are pretty tight between them. So, I will probably, and I didn't write anything that wasn't fully outlined. And I will probably end up writing the other two narratives, like I said, separately, but the story's going to be very, 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 I'll know exactly how I'm telling the story and exactly how each narrative will unfold before I completely tackle each one.
Gotcha. Well, given your experience with Haven Point and now working on your second novel, what writing advice would you offer for those who are working on their own stories and novels?
I think, obviously, it's going to sound hackneyed. I know everyone says it, but I think the best thing you can do for your writing is reading. I didn't get an MFA. Every time I say that, I picture people saying, yeah, no kidding. But I do think I absorbed a lot of the conventions of novel writing. And I would imagine this is true. I've never really written short stories, but I imagine if you, you know, want to write short stories, the great thing to do is consume a lot of them. I just think from reading, you know, hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of novels, I understood a lot about how to, you know, how to go about it. I made a lot of mistakes, but the one thing I feel like I did well was I knew when something wasn't working. I didn't mm-hmm. always know immediately how to fix it. I would, and occasionally I would resist it and want to just be satisfied with how I had written it, but I couldn't let something rest until I dealt with it. I knew when I had too much exposition and it was affecting the pacing, for example. And, you know, it's hard when that happens because it means you have to take something that might be a 3 or 4 paragraphs and condense it into something much smaller that has the same impact, which is a good writerly exercise, but challenging. So I would say reading is the best thing you can do, and a willingness to take advice. I mean, I suppose sort of a natural humility about this. It never bothered me that someone might have a better idea. And I also had, I think, reasonable discernment. I mean, as I said, I used a professional editor at one point, and I would say immediately 65-70% of her suggestions I thought were fantastic. And there were some I didn't end up agreeing with, but there were others that I initially didn't, but I ended up moving in her direction on. So finding good readers you trust, it doesn't have to be a hired editor. That was a luxury. But there are, you know, you can't listen to everybody. Everyone's going to have different thoughts, but an openness and also confidence in your own discernment, as I said, I think is probably what helped me the most.
Sure. Well, what novels or nonfiction books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
It's more autofiction, so it's almost combining the two. Martin Amis, who is a British writer, his father was Kingsley Amis, the novelist. Mm-hmm. He relatively recently, released his Inside Story, which is, again, somewhat autobiographical, but sort of bleeds into fiction. It's really interesting, I think some of the critics haven't loved the structure. It is a little odd. Mm-hmm. And it's very discursive, but I like him a lot. He's very funny. I prefer, if I'm reading literary fiction, a little humor is nice leavening, and he's amusing. He was very good friends with Christopher Hitchens, who was an interesting public intellectual. And so, a lot of the novel is about that. And it's also about his relationship with Saul Bellow. So I found it fascinating. I love his humor. I love British writers in general. And I thought that was terrific. Another I really enjoyed, completely different, Jenny Fields wrote a biographical fiction, Age of Desire, about Edith Wharton. And I originally picked it up for research purposes because sort of time period wise coincides with my second novel, and I found it incredibly engaging. Completely forgot that I was supposed to be thinking about it in more clinical terms. Jenny Fields is very good in terms of historical fiction at weaving in very seamlessly historical details. You don't feel clubbed over the head with them,
right?
And so I love that. And then another one, not quite so recent, but a great favorite of mine that's also different, was Linda Holmes's Evie Drake Starts Over, which she put out a couple of years ago, and it took me a little while to get to it, but it was great fun. It was a romantic story, a crackling humor, great dialogue. And I had a lot of fun with that.
That's great. Well, where can people find you online if they're interested in learning more about you and your debut novel, Haven Point?
Oh, thank you. So I do have a website, virginiahume.com, and I'm also on Twitter at Virginia Hume, and on Instagram at Virginia Hume, and on Facebook, I don't know what the address is, Virginia Hume author. So I'm everywhere. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me everywhere. I did public relations. I'm all over social media. I don't know if I've made the transition to using these platforms for my authorly purposes, but there I am. And I'm always happy to engage with people, especially after this long year of engaging with almost nobody.
Exactly. Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Virginia Hume, author of the debut novel, Haven Point. The book is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Virginia, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It was fun.
Now, stay tuned for a brief excerpt from the audiobook of Haven Point by Virginia Hume, narrated by Cassandra Campbell, available from Macmillan Audio, wherever audiobooks are sold.
Prologue. August 2008, Haven Point, Maine. Marin took her mug of coffee outside and sank into the wicker love seat. Skye would finally arrive the following day. Marin had so much she needed to tell her granddaughter. The conversation was long overdue, but Marin was still uncertain how to go about it, or even where to begin. From the water came the sound of a horn, and Marin looked up to see a race underway. For the next half hour, she watched sailboats fly across the bay, white sails trimmed to harness the brisk breeze. The boats rounded their mark and went behind Gunnison Island. But from her perch high on the cliff, Marin could still catch glimpses of the mastheads when they emerged from behind clumps of spruce, like stealthy hunters gliding between coverts. The cannon shot signaling the end of the race startled Marin from her reverie. She had been like this since her daughter died 6 months earlier, wavering between agonizing grief and a strange fugue state. Most days, she had found herself sitting in this very spot for hours, just staring out at the water. If Georgie was right, and she usually was, the hurricane barreling toward the coast could cause problems on Haven Point. It was hard to imagine, given the crisp air and sapphire sky today, but Marin had spent enough summers here to know how quickly the skies could change. With no more effort than it took to wipe a cloth across a dusty shelf, a storm could mock their efforts to tame this wild peninsula. Go ahead, build your roads, carve your paths, plant your gardens. Never forget who's really in charge, though. She and Skye would be fine in Four Winds, of course. The old house had faced down plenty of weather in its day. Marin sat listening to the ocean, engaged in its violent, noisy, age-old battle with the rocks below. That strangely pacifying sound was the heartbeat of this house. She'd always thought of Four Winds as a living thing, pulsing, thrumming, speaking to her. She had loved it from the first, even when she so mistrusted the community outside its doors. Skye did not know it yet, but Four Winds would be hers someday. Marin had planned to leave it to both her children. But a few years earlier, Billy had made his wishes clear. "I love it there, but I've lived abroad my whole adult life. Let Annie have the house," he'd said. "She wouldn't want it." "You never know," Billy replied with a gentle smile. "She just might decide to come back to Haven Point someday." Billy had been right. In the end, the very end, Annie had wanted to come back. Her granddaughter did not know this yet, either. After the memorial service, Skye had asked what they would do with the ashes. "We can figure it out later," Marin had said. Skye had been satisfied. She had no reason to imagine her mother, flaky on her best day, downright reckless on her worst, had left detailed instructions on that or any subject. There was so much Skye didn't understand about her mother. Marin rose and went inside to the living room. Her eyes took in the books, trophies, and pictures that crowded the shelves. They were all there, the Demarest women, layered over one another like a fossil record. Even Annie. Her daughter might have abandoned this house, but Four Winds had not returned the favor. She was everywhere. Her name next to Charlie's on the Stiniford Cup trophy, her face in photographs, her soul in paintings and drawings. And she lived on in Skye, too. Marin smiled at the memory of Oliver's reaction all those years before, when Annie told them she had decided to have a baby.
"Ah, artificial insemination,"
Oliver had nodded in his doctorly way, as if she had told him she planned to try a new heartburn medication.
"What an interesting idea. Do clinics provide this service to single women?"
"I think so. I'm still looking into it," Annie had said breezily. "If not, Flora said she would pretend she's my lover." How Oliver had not fallen out of his chair at that moment, Marin would never know. But of course, he was careful with Annie after everything that happened. They promised to love Skye, to do all they could to help raise her. They hadn't realized what they were signing up for, but it never mattered. From the first moment they were so beguiled by the little redhead, they would have cheerfully laid down their lives for her. Still, Skye saw Haven Point as her mother had. Beautiful on the surface, petty and snobbish underneath. Marin understood. She had once felt the same way. It was only in the worst moment of her life that she realized what she'd missed. Just as the big storms wiped out Haven Point Road, exposing the bedrock beneath, it had taken grief and pain washing everything away for Marin to finally see the community's sturdy foundation, its titanic heart. Marin recalled a maxim Annie used to share with her art students at the start of each semester. Everything depends on the quality and direction of light. It was only in the last year that Annie had finally applied this lesson to her own life, that she relinquished the story she had clung to for so long about what had happened here and who was responsible. By then, it had been too late. But it was not too late for Skye.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big.